Good morning. The move to make Mauna Loa Bay a special sanctuary management area has some residents angry, but is what's making them upset really true? Malama Mauna Loa Executive Director Fraser McGillivray disentangles fact from fiction later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. He's been called the Golden Gate Guardian. This week, Kevin Briggs is in Hawaii to talk about how to prevent suicide. We'll talk with him in a few minutes. It's Wednesday, June 17th from HPR2. It's The Conversation.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and folk artist Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary is coming to Honolulu, keeping alive the tradition of music with a message. And there are too few remaining species of native forest birds in Hawaii, but there are efforts to save them. We'll speak with Laura Berthold of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project.
The conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Hello there and happy Wednesday, Chris Vandercook.
Happy Wednesday, Beth Ann. I'm really looking forward to this first conversation of yours today.
Well, it's kind of a strange thing to think about looking forward to, but in some ways there are some very, very good parts about talking about issues like suicide. And
much
how
to be learned.
Yeah, and what's to be learned, and also what lessons you take from that and move into other areas of your life when you're talking about really, really sitting down and being able to talk to somebody, or in some case, keep them from doing something perfectly horrible.
Exactly.
Now, some places are known for their reputations to aid suicide. The San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge fits into that category, and perhaps few know that as well as Kevin Briggs. In his long career with the California Highway Patrol, many years included a route along the southern end of the bridge that developed into a part of the job he hadn't expected. As a suicide prevention counselor. Often called the Golden Gate Guardian, he has talked several hundred people out of ending their lives. He spoke about it in last year's TED Talks and about what all of us need to know. Listening well can mean the difference between life and death. Kevin Briggs, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
When we talk about suicide, it's always with a feeling for so many people of, this is not a nice subject to talk about. This is a hurtful, deeply painful thing to bring about, especially when you talk to people who are either contemplating suicide or to loved ones left after someone who has committed suicide. But the thread through all of this, as you've said and said in your TED Talk too, is that there are listening skills that all of us need to use that we don't use even in daily life that might pick up some of these signs well before it ever comes to the point of suicide. What specifically do you mean?
Right. Well, we don't address suicide as a society, as the world, really. We're just beginning to do this now. The stigma surrounding it, we're scared of it. Nobody wants to talk about this, really, because people don't understand what's going on with it. They don't understand why could you do it? Why would you take your own life? But they also don't understand the pain that people are in. They say it's a selfish act. It's not a selfish act. These people are in so much pain, they just want their pain to end. They don't want to hurt anyone. They would definitely not want to hurt their families. But they are tired of the pain that they're suffering through. It's been going on a lot of times for many years. What I try to do is get people to communicate. Communicate long before they ever come up to that bridge. So if someone is depressed or bipolar or just going through very, very bad times, to be able to come out and talk about that, to have the courage to talk about it, and for the listener to take the time to really sit down with them in a comfortable setting, not in a coffee shop or somewhere in public, where they can really sit down with them and try to understand what is going on and be there for them, and be there for them 24 hours a day if they need to call them in the middle of the night. This is how we can protect each other. If I'm going through some bad times, I know there's some people that I can call. I may wake them up, but they know that I know that they're there for me, and I will do the same. As a society, we can go a lot further by just sitting back and trying to understand what each of us is going through. We're going to have hard times, but we know that women live longer than men, and they do generally because they get together and they talk about what's going on. If us as men, I was in the Army, I worked in state corrections and prisons, and I worked with the California Highway Patrol, all these big macho jobs. I never talked about all the things that happened with me. And it developed into depression. And still to this day, I take medication for it. But when I learn to open up, and when I speak around the world now, is I open up everything about me. And I believe in that because it sets an example for others to see, oh, it's okay. This guy did it, so I can do it. I've actually made thousands of more friends after doing this.
You've been able to speak very publicly about something that you a moment ago said really ideally should be talked about in a place of quiet safety. You're doing that to be able to make the point that you can even get to the place where you are now, but it's got to start someplace else with all of us listening to each other and being willing to take the time. We live in such a frenetic society. Everything is just changing by the nanosecond, and everyone is seemingly, you know, caught with an attention span, you know, just of a hummingbird. How do you intervene in that way where there is so much freneticism and give a space to, for this to be really discussed?
Right. We're living in an age of high blood pressure, high cholesterol. Our blood isn't doing so slick these days, and I'm right there with it. If we find the time to maybe meditate, to slow down, you will find that, wow, you breathe less times a minute. You can take more in. And you'll find if you took some time each day to have a friend and go out for some coffee, or if someone is in need, to talk to them at your place or their place in confidence and to just sit down with them, let them know what's going on. It really, really has an effect on your whole person. You're more relaxed, and to be able to help someone when they're going through those struggles, to be there for them, you will gain so much respect, and how you feel about yourself. It's just, wow, I was able to help someone today. Look what this did.
We don't really grow up in a society where we're taught how to help other people. It's usually seen as some other extracurricular activity that will potentially look good on your resume or look good as you go off to college. You're talking about a sense of deep caring and connection with people, maybe just a handful of people. I'm thinking about once upon a time when my father and all of his really close friends would meet every morning at Howard Johnson's for coffee before they went off to do whatever they were going to do. But that daily connection and rhythm of that created a different life pattern for them. And that's in a sense when I hear you talking about being able to connect with somebody or something else besides what you need to do in your daily life to get your job done or to finish the tasks on your list.
Right. And we see this with a lot of retirees. They decide they all get together at a certain place, a certain donut shop or somewhere. They all get together at a Starbucks or something. And they start off their day with laughter, with talking about what's going on in their life. They have what's going on with them is happening with a lot of other people. They can bounce ideas off, they can share information, and they laugh about a lot of things.
Okay, but when you get to the point where life has moved along and now you're dealing with someone who is suicidal, and for a parent there's probably no worse idea, short of having a child killed in an accident, than to think about a child taking his or her own life. How do you begin to approach that when it's reached a level that's, you know, far beyond just hearing some of the signs or maybe picking up some of the signals way back?
Right. So if you're seeing these things, and we'll take a child, for instance, maybe they were bullying, maybe they had some forced life changes, going to a different school because you moved, and maybe the grades were in the A and B range, and now they're in the C and D range. They're unkempt. All these different things. They used to be very outgoing.
Big changes in behavior.
Yes.
You're saying.
So you're seeing these things. If you're the one that's going to approach, if you think you have that rapport with your child, do it where they're comfortable. Maybe in their room, or maybe outside somewhere in a park. Something you want to be able to allow them to release their feelings. And they're not going to do that in the general public. No one wants to do that. I would approach them and tell them what I'm seeing and say, hey, normalize what's going on with them. Normalize with anyone, really. We're going through all these people with these feelings, and what is happening with this kid?
So I want you to normalize.
I want you to know that what you're going through happens to many, many people. We're going to normalize them so they don't feel alone. They feel alone and isolated, when in fact they're not. So if we can normalize their feelings, and then if it gets down to the point where you think they may be suicidal or contemplating it, ask them the question, have you been having thoughts of killing yourself? Not, are you going to hurt yourself? Have you been having thoughts of hurting yourself? It's a way different thing. A lot of people who want to die don't want to hurt. They don't want to have the pain. But have you been having thoughts of killing yourself? Now, what if they say yes? Think about that before you get to that conversation. Have some kind of plan to answer that, to go through that.
And what should be in that plan?
Resources. Have a doctor's note in there, who you're going to see, who you may want to call. There are great resources from such places as NAMI and AFSP, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, so you don't go in there blindsided in case it does come to this. And don't freak out if that person does say, yes, I have been having those thoughts. Okay, let's dig a little deeper. How long have you had these thoughts? Do you have a plan? Have you tried this before? And if you did, what stopped you?
That's an awful lot for a parent to sometimes deal with, even though a parent may be trying to create a better outcome. What else do you advise for the parent as they're trying to cope with all this that they may hear?
Right. It takes a lot of courage to do this, but this is your child. This is your loved one. It is so important to watch for your kids, to look for these things. If this is occurring, I would do it on a one-on-one. That's another thing. I wouldn't have it two or three adults or anything like that come in with a family, and it looks like you're against this individual. A one-on-one, show them, I'm scared about what's going on. I'm scared for you, and it frightens me what I'm seeing. I'd like to see what we can do to get through this together.
Kevin Briggs, thank you so much for coming in. I wish we had more time to talk.
Well, thank you very much.
Kevin Briggs, a.k.a. the Guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge, is a retired sergeant with the California Highway Patrol. He now tours and talks about, among other things, suicide prevention.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16, and later in the show, keeping the folk music tradition alive 50 years down the road. But first, your quiz.
Later in the show, we'll talk about Hawaii's native birds, and that brought to mind one of the many beautiful species that has gone extinct in our islands. The reasons for extinction of native birds are many: habitat loss, introduced diseases, and overhunting. The bird we're focusing on this morning was prized for its old and yellow feathers, which were used for the featherwork that adorned Hawaiian royalty. Kamehameha the Great's famous feather cloak was made entirely from the feathers of this bird, and an estimated 80,000 of them were killed to make the single garment. This bird lives high in the forest, where it feeds on lobelia nectar, which it drew from the plant with its curved little beak. It was mostly black in color, with the yellow and gold feathers that made it so valuable on its rump and tail. Hawaiians collected the birds by removing sap from sandalwood trees and breadfruit to create a sticky paste that they place near the blossoms of lobelias. Then the birds would drink the nectar, and their feet would get stuck in the sap. The bird's Latin name is Drepanis pacifica, but for our backyard quiz today, we're looking for its Hawaiian name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and if you're fast and first, you'll get the t-shirt.
Good morning. My name is Larry Geller. I blog at Disappeared News, and I'm president of Kukua Castle. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Every Peter Yarrow performance carries a message, and has been that way for more than 50 years. This is the man who, as part of the hugely popular folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary, sang Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind for 250,000 people at the 1963 March on Washington, just before Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Folk musicians of his generation look at social engagement as an essential part of their music. Peter's coming to town. He's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, my friend, and I'm looking forward to being with you. It's the first time I've been back to Hawaii in many, many, many years, and Peter Paul Mary used to sing at the Waikiki Shell each year during the 60s, but I'm very excited about coming back, and there's a purpose to my coming back as well.
There's always a purpose to your performances, am I right?
Yes, that's true. And this one in particular has to do with a benefit that it's a concert that I'm going to be doing with my daughter and Bethany Yarrow and my son Christopher Yarrow, both of whom are musicians. Mm-hmm. And they are activists too. And the effort that it's going to be supporting is the preservation of the reefs, which are disappearing at 5 times the rate of, the rainforest. It's a critical issue in terms of the planet's survival. And there's a project going on that benefits youth and gives them scholarships for marine conservation projects at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology at the University of Hawaii. So I'm very excited about doing that. And singing with a purpose is in my blood, and it's in my kids' blood, too.
When you started out, that was a big part of what folk singers did, right? The civil rights movement, social engagement as part of, a tradition that went back well before you folks came along, right?
Indeed. Mary used to call us Seeger's Raiders, which meant that we really followed Pete Seeger's footsteps.
Yeah.
Mary and I came from a very, very progressive background, and so it was in our blood. Noel was from the Midwest, and Les had that in his background, but he adopted it and embraced it.
Mm-hmm.
So in our singing, whether it was for the civil rights movement or whether it was for the anti-war movement in the Vietnam War and organizing in that regard, or whether the women's movement, and now certainly for me, the environmental movement is huge and hugely important, as it is for my daughter, who is a particularly effective anti-fracking activist and climate activist. This tradition continues.
For every social movement in American history that I can think of, Peter, there's a song, right? You can't scare me. I'm sticking.
Not just a song. There are many, many songs. The labor movement had many, many songs, and that preceded by a long time the civil rights movement. There, of course, that's the case. Yes.
But I'm trying to get at, Peter, I think, is the capacity of a song to sort of coalesce the emotions around an issue, yeah?
Well, yes. I would say that if you listen to John Lewis's speeches, where he talks about the importance of music in the civil rights movement, he said, without that music, it just wouldn't have had that energy. And the singing of We Shall Overcome and Blowing in the Wind and the songs that the Freedom Singers, I Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round, mm-hmm. and songs like that were extraordinarily important in terms of mobilizing people's hearts to work together, and that still is the case.
Because giving people facts and figures about an issue can only take you so far, yeah?
Agreed. People need to be heart connected, and music helps to do that. And I've known that all my performing career, and I rely on that. That's really why I'm doing it, because I love the music, but because it creates and mobilizes efforts to deal with problems and to advance perspectives that are desperately needed in our time.
The preservation of the reef obviously being something that's very important to people in Hawaii, and I think you'll also find, Peter, on a rewarding side of the ledger, that it's one where people in Hawaii are pretty well informed, which is all to the good, right?
Absolutely, and it's great. And I'm hoping that the people that come to see me on June 26th, when I link the history of Peter, Paul, and Mary to the struggle to maintain the reefs and not let them disappear as they are, will be emphasized in that way, because these songs are very, very elastic. And what we'll be singing about then is quite specific, but it stands on the shoulders of those movements for so many years.
And those songs remain, songs from 50, 60 years ago remain relevant today, don't they, Peter?
Indeed they are relevant. And I will be singing with my daughter, Bethany, and my son, Christopher, the Peter, Paul, and Mary songbook, so that you can expect to hear not only If I Had a Hammer, Blowing in the Wind, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, etc., but also Puff the Magic Dragon and Leaving on a Jet Plane, because we're not simply singing protest songs, we're singing songs that are reflect the spectrum of our experience, and that's the nature of folk music, too.
Makes sense to me, Peter. Thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Okay. I'm looking forward to seeing you, my friend.
It'll be great. Thank you. Peter Yarrow will perform Friday, June 26th at the UH Manoa Campus Center Ballroom, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned?
If you know someone in the military on Oahu, you may also know that a military housing allowance is often in excess of fair market values. And that has been driving up rents. Civil Beat's Chad Blair has done some checking, and he's got a reality check for us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, I mean, we talk about this sort of, we've talked around this a little bit, but really looking at what is the difference between what the housing allowance for a military person would be and what would be a fair market value, and you put some real numbers to that. What are we looking at in terms of real difference in dollars?
Well, I got to give credit to Eric Pape, who's been doing our Living Hawaii series, and he did the fact checking and the digging to find out what these numbers are. So, if you're a low level enlistee in the armed forces here, at minimum, you're going to get $2,200 a month. If you've got dependents, it's going to be $3,000. And if you're an officer, like particularly a brigadier general or a rear admiral, that's more like $3,800 to $4,300. Well, the market value, the fair market rent for a three-bedroom here on Oahu is $2,600. So you can see that on average, the military personnel are getting, you know, about $900 more than that fair market. And that's a big reason why our rents are so high. Now, I do want to caution right away. There's a lot of reasons why expensive housing and affordable housing is such a big deal here in Hawaii, particularly on Oahu. We're not blaming the military. But Eric's point is that the fact that the military has this housing allowance means they have a competitive advantage, and that advantage is growing.
Well, I mean, what landlord wouldn't rather take somebody who's going to pay them more than, you know, fewer dollars? But the whole issue is that we have lots of different reasons why, you know, costs may be more, and when we would take your point. But still, when you have a landlord who's looking at taking, you know, rent from a military person who may be willing to pay them much more than not, is there any way around that for the average person who also may have the same dollars to be able to rent that house in theory?
You know, Eric talked to a lot of real estate experts, and, you know, landlords will not publicly tell you that they prefer military renters, right? That would be discrimination. But the reality is yes, they absolutely do prefer military renters because, yes, they know they're getting more money. By the way, they're less likely to skip their rent. And if they do misbehave, guess what? Those landlords can call the commander and say, hey, you know, I mean, that's a pretty good way to make sure that you have a safe, dependable tenant. So this is definitely a factor for the rest of us. There's at least 22,000 military personnel on Oahu that are living off base, taking up about 5,500 rental units that could otherwise go to civilians.
And no indication that there's going to be backtracking anytime soon to make it all fair market rental. All right. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
In love with an outlaw.
It runs the whole gamut of very coerced sexual situations to seemingly romantic relationships, and it is very difficult to see who is manipulating who.
Sex between inmates and staff is a crime, whether or not there's a daring escape from prison. Is it being treated that way? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, following The Conversation.
I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll talk with members of the Science Communicators Ohana.
Understanding science is more important than ever. What strategies, tools, and platforms work best to advance science literacy?
That's today at 5 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
This next conversation highlights just how different perspectives of not good can be. He says the decline of Mauna Loa Bay is the worst in the state, not good. He is Fraser McGilvray, the executive director of the conservation group Malama Mauna Loa. Then there are the protesters who say losing access to ocean recreation is also not good. Is information misshaping or shaping how East Honolulu residents are reacting to the proposed NOAA proposal to make the bay a special sanctuary management area? Fraser McGilvray thinks so. He joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Now, on Saturday, you know, we saw some of those protesters out there and big signs that say, stop the feds from stealing Hawaii's waters again, pamphlets being distributed. A lot of fear and a lot of people really upset that somehow they're going to lose access and have their homes lose value. What is it that you tell them when they're coming to you with such, you know, fearful possibilities?
I think there's an awful lot of misinformation out there. In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And sadly, there's an awful lot of one-eyed kings out there. And so a lot of the information that's being spread is just not true. It's based on fear factors, and it's being spread by a small handful of people who want no regulations, whether they be state regulations, whether they be federal regulations. And you know, we've seen this for a long time regarding any changes for positive conservation or positive resource management. The same people come out and spread much of the same information that this is going to inhibit whatever it happens to be that people want to do and like to do, when it's just simply not true.
I got to ask you, since you've said there's a small handful of people, do you know who these people are?
We suspect. We have our suspicions, but obviously, you know, we can't come out and directly say who we think they are at this point. But I think many people who are listening to this know who these people are and can recognize the same fingerprints on this as in the fingerprints on many other things that have happened against good natural resource management regulations throughout the state.
The Bay, as we've known for a long time, has been in trouble. It's still a whale sanctuary, and even if this expanded version were not to happen, it would still be a whale sanctuary. But the point still remains that it's in bad shape. What do you do going forward to be able to make your case of why it should be expanded into a special management area?
I mean, I think one of the things that we've seen, a lot of people are saying, well, the state control it and the state can just carry on doing that. And I think if that's probably the case, but if the state were actually able to do their job and had the funding to do their job, I mean, it's not through want of trying, it's a distinct lack of funding. But they're not able to keep this bay in the state that it once was in, and we're all working towards trying to restore it. And that's what, you know, these regulations would help us do. These regulations do not stop you fishing. They don't stop you boating. They don't stop you anchoring in sand. They don't stop Hawaii Kai Marina being dredged. All of those things there are just lies. It doesn't do any of that.
Those things are part of what's being perpetuated in the no, don't do this perspective. This is not good. Even when you've told people this, how are they reacting when you show them and say, well, wait a minute, what you're saying is just patently not true. Have a look at this. Did you actually read it?
Some people are in disbelief because I'm one voice versus, you know, the pamphlets that are flying around. I don't go out and wave signs like, you know, some people do on the side of the road. And I guess in many cases, it's not necessarily the fault of the people who are waving the signs. They're being told this information and they're believing this information. But sadly, the information they're being told just isn't true.
Don't they have an obligation, though, to actually read through and see what the, you know, expanded plan would do?
They certainly could. I mean, it's a very large document for the entire state. And remember, Monolua Bay is not the only area that the sanctuary is looking to either geographically or managerially expand into. But Monolua Bay seems to be the focal point of much of the anti-campaigning. I agree with you that, you know, most people, if you don't know, do go and read. It's a very big document, but there is an executive summary. It's an excellent executive summary. It's only 11 pages. It's online. You can go and read it and actually find out what this does and what it doesn't do. The Monolua Bay section is quite small as well, and it's quite clear. So I would urge anyone who has received one of these flyers that says Hawaii Kai is going to turn into a swamp, which just isn't true, because harbors have an exemption under this, so we can still continue to dredge harbors, and actually find out for yourself. Go find it. It's online. It's on the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale Sanctuary website.
Why do you think Maua Bay has become the focal point of this when this document moves in so many different other directions?
I think it's basically because the population that's down there. We have 60,000 people that live on the bay. And according to surveys that we've done, 98% of them actually, or the people that we've surveyed, actually say that a good quality in the bay and a healthy bay is integral to their quality of life. Sadly, the bay is in decline, has been in decline. We're trying to reverse that through the efforts that Malama Mauna Loa and various other partners and various industry partners are actually doing as well. We spent yesterday morning with Island Divers and had an excellent time and an excellent conversation with them, and they believe this is a good thing, and it's beneficial to their business, and they rely on a healthy environment for their business.
What happens now?
We have 2 days left for people to comment on the NOAA proposals. And then, of course, they then NOAA have to go and figure out, you know, what they're going to do with this. And discussions with the state have to continue. Discussions with the state were ongoing, in the previous administration, and are being carried into this administration as well. Obviously, political wills change from one administration to the other, and we're not quite sure where the state government currently sits. The one thing that we know is we need strong state government presence here. No one doesn't believe that. We need the state to be strong in this and be a full co-manager of this expansion of the sanctuary in Mauna Loa Bay.
Do you expect that will happen?
I really have no idea. I mean, I think the jury is still out on that one. Governor Abercrombie was much more, was a supporter of co-management in Mauna Loa Bay. We don't quite know what this current governor seems to think about this, but fingers crossed that the state will realize that it doesn't have the resources and to be able to do everything and will accept this offer from the federal government to help co-manage these areas, which are integral for future generations, both from their education and their recreation, which everyone will still be able to do. Mm-hmm. If people weren't able to continue to use this bay, I wouldn't be sitting here in support of these regulations. I would be out on the street waving the signs as well.
But when you talk about DLNR and strong presence of the state, every legislative session we hear how much money DLNR doesn't have and how underfunded it is and how it can't do all the things that it would like to do. So relying on the state from your perspective in that way seems to be, you know, waiting for them to do something that's not possible, which is why you're asking that there be a strong state presence to say that, okay, this needs to be expanded and that this no proposal needs to go forward.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, DLNR receives 1% of the state's budget to manage the resources that it has. It's woefully underfunded. And if you were just to take a comparison of any other state or any other country, protecting the natural resources gets much higher budget. And let's face it, people come to Hawaii for our natural resources. They come here because we have beautiful water, we have beautiful beaches, we have palm trees, we have beautiful uplands. If we don't protect those areas, people will start to look elsewhere and go elsewhere.
Well, even for the people who live in East Honolulu, who are looking at this as being their bay and obviously wanting to enjoy it in lots of different forms, but the idea of it being a healthy bay, which clearly hasn't been the case for many a year.
I think that's right. We spoke with a lady yesterday who has lived on the bay for 72 years. She was born in the same house that she lives in currently. And she actually told us about the decline in the bay that she's seen in her lifetime. And she actually believes that we now have a chance to start to restore it by bringing, you know, by accepting the expansion and the co-management.
We've talked a lot about what this won't do. Let's be real specific about what it will do.
I think what it will do is it will allow for effective management. It will potentially bring federal resources to allow us to manage these locations around the state. It will also allow for certain infractions of the bay which would then be in contravention of the National Marine Sanctuaries Act. So, for example, sediment running into the bay would be in contravention of the act, and we would be able to do something about that, where right now it's much more difficult to do so.
And if you can put it down to one thing that you want people to take away from this conversation as they look at Mauna Loa Bay, what would it be?
We need more corals, we need more fish, and we need everyone to continue enjoying the bay as much as they possibly can and as much as they do today.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fraser McGillivray is the executive director of Malama Mauna Loa. It's an internationally renowned marine natural resource management professional with more than 25 years experience. We've been talking about the issue with Mauna Loa Bay and other places around the state that might be expanded into special management areas under the NOAA proposal.
Aloha, I'm Leslie Cole Brooks from the Hawaii Solar Energy Association. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we're looking at a native Hawaiian bird that has gone extinct, the last living specimen having been spotted in 1898. It was a victim of its own beauty, the bright yellow and gold feathers on its rump and tail being a coveted material for the beautiful feather cloaks favored by Hawaiian royalty. They were found only on the island of Hawaii and had a long curved beak adapted for drawing nectar from flowers. They were said to remember and resemble another Hawaiian bird called the o'o and were sometimes called o'o nuku'umu, which means o'o with the sucking beak. Full grown, they were about 9 inches long, lived in the high forest canopy, where hunters would trap them using a paste made of the sap from sandalwood and breadfruit trees. They would step in the paste and get stuck there, easy prey for the hunter. The bird's Latin name is Drepanus pacifica, but we were looking for the Hawaiian name, which is mamo. And at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And as the backyard quiz just reminded us, the human presence on these islands has decimated their native bird population. Fewer than 40 species survived from the hundreds that once thrived here. Laura Berthold of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project is one of those who are dedicated to saving the species that remain and educating the public about efforts to keep them alive. She's on the phone with us from Maui. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. The causes of extinction are probably the ones that we could expect to know about, right? Just the human presence, loss of habitat, diseases. What else?
Well, not only are humans here, but we also have different introductions of mm-hmm. non-native plants and insects. We also have non-native feral ungulates like cows, pigs, deer, and goats, and they can actually do damage to the native forests and habitat for the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have introduced insects like mosquitoes that can carry diseases that the birds aren't adapted to live with. So many of them die because of avian malaria and avian pox.
And how do you combat something like a disease among forest birds? How can you treat that or prevent it?
That's definitely a hard question and one that's still being answered.
Yeah.
One thing to do, though, is to protect their current habitat where there are disease-free areas mm-hmm. and also preventing any mosquito habitat from occurring. So if you have pigs out of the system, they actually create these little wallows for mosquitoes to breed. So if you get them out, you won't have those little areas for mosquitoes to breed.
Yeah, in a forest where the feral pigs have gotten in, there's all this mud and all this standing water, and mosquitoes love standing water, right?
Correct, yeah. So and then if you also try to restore some of the native forest that's higher up in elevation where mosquitoes aren't found, that's also a really good way to combat it as well.
So you remove, basically you're attacking, I mean, you obviously you can't vaccinate birds, but you can get rid of the mosquitoes. It sounds like that's the best plan of attack for that.
Well, there's high elevation areas that are mosquito-free areas but just because of the cooler temperatures that kind of prevent them from occurring up there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with climate change, that could all change, but restoring and protecting those areas that are disease-free right now is really important. And that's one of our goals of the organization is to restore native habitats and hopefully reintroduced some of the birds to the leeward east side of Maui.
When you do the native, you know, with these areas that are safe and mosquito-free, do the remaining birds sort of naturally gravitate toward those areas? the birds that aren't living in them? Do they move toward the higher ground, as it were?
Well, if some of the birds will go lower in elevation, and they will actually get the diseases, and most of those birds will die. Mm-hmm. So that's why most of them aren't going lower down. It's just kind of a natural effect of them going down lower in elevation and dying from the diseases.
Because the disease is, oh, sounds as if it's almost always fatal, yeah?
Correct.
So no chance of any kind of immunities developing naturally. You just have to eliminate the source, yeah?
Yeah, that I know of right now.
So there's habitat restoration. There's elimination of non-native invasives, which is, of course, a huge problem on a number of levels.
Yeah, definitely a big battle.
Which are the most, put it this way, I'm thinking in terms of which species are most endangered, but maybe I should phrase it as which are the ones that you can do the most for? Which species?
Well, the ones that my organization, Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project, works on are the Hawaiian honeycreepers. Mm-hmm. Many of these birds are endangered. We've lost over a half of these species, and currently a third of the nation's endangered birds are in Hawaii. And so we focus on the Maui parapil, or the kiwi-kiu, which has a population of about 500, which is a sad number, but a good number for us to deal with.
Sure. Manageable in terms of your numbers, right?
Yeah, there's some species that have less than 500.
Is it important to sort of, you just sort of raised another issue that's interesting, which is going at a problem that is at the right scale to be one where you can make a difference, yeah?
Yeah, it's definitely kind of figuring out what goals are the highest priorities and, you know, what sorts of things you can do to combat it. And it is definitely a never-ending struggle, but... You know, right now our priority is to restore native forest and to hopefully reintroduce the parrotbill to that area where we are restoring.
You know, I'm just looking at a picture of them. They really are extraordinary. They're kind of unusual looking with that beak is much more like a parrot beak than what you would expect to see, yeah?
Yes, and that's why they have that nickname, Maui Parrotbill, because it's kind of a parrot-like bill, but it's a specialized bill. The upper part of their bill is longer than their lower part, and it's really, really strong. They actually use it to kind of pry open bark and dig into bark to eat insect larvae or caterpillars.
So that can be a really fragile balance. I mean, as soon as anything affects the insect population, they're going to be affected, right? It's specialized on both sides in a way.
Yes, correct. And most of the native birds will only feed on native insects or utilize native trees. So having that native forest is really important for that.
Do they find that if they feed on non-native insects, are there some that are harmful to them? Or are there things they might feed on, introduce things they might feed on that can do them harm?
Not that I know of.
So they naturally stay away from that, yeah? It's more a question of the scarcity of food for them.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty... How long has this been your mission, Laura?
I've personally worked with the project since 2009.
Mm-hmm. And in the course of a day, I mean, you do educational outreach, and you're coming to the Manoa Library in a week or so. What other things, you know, fill up your working day?
That's a good question. Well, during the birds breeding season, which is January to June, it's pretty long here on the islands because of the nice weather, we will go out into the forest and we monitor the current kiwi-kiu population. So we go searching for the birds. We try to put color bands on them so we can tell individuals apart. We can tell more about their genetics and survival and pair relations and reproduction by doing those surveys. And then another part of my job is to plant native seedlings on the other side of the mountain, on the leeward side, where the kiwi-kiu aren't currently found, but they used to be. So that's a lot of hard work of walking up and down the mountain and planting native plants.
Well, Laura, it's good to talk to you. Sounds as if there's plenty to keep you busy. Thanks for taking the time.
Yes, definitely, and I hope people can make it out to the presentation next week.
I hope so, too. Thank you. Laura Berthold of the Maui Forest Bird Recovering Project will speak about the forest birds of Hawaii and the research and management efforts on their behalf on Thursday, June 25th at 6:30 p.m. at the Manoa Public Library. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Bob Dylan paid this tribute to Jimi Hendrix. He took some small songs of mine that nobody paid any attention to and brought them up into the outer limits of the stratosphere. Now it's Hawaii blues singer and guitarist Dion Boogie Scott singing Hendrix, singing Dylan. Check out this event in HPR's Atherton studio Saturday, June 20th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at hawaiipublicradio.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours.
We started the hour talking about suicide prevention, and at the very top of the show, you said that you were really interested to hear what Kevin Briggs had to say. How did that resonate with you?
Well, it was a really fascinating conversation. I talked to him a little bit before the show, and one of the things he said that struck me was never say to a person in extremis, as the people he's dealing with, never say, I understand. Understand that you don't understand where they're coming from, that you know, the effort that might seem to come naturally to people to create a bond by saying, I understand, can be a very bad idea in a situation like that.
Take the I out of it and just keep it focused on the person you're talking to.
Yeah.
What's led you to do this? What can I do to help?
Exactly.
Well, we'll talk more about that because we know we have issues with suicide here in Hawaii, among other places too. But that's going to do it for us for the conversation for this morning. Tomorrow we're going to talk with Senator Brian Schatz about trade.
And legendary bassist Jack Cassidy, founding member of the Jefferson Airplane and half of Hot Tuna, will join us in our studio.
You can call our talkback line anytime you like to leave us comments. That number is 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning back here for more of The Conversation. See you then.